So we're listening together in this series that we've called Kingdom Culture to Jesus' example and teaching as it's provided for us in the Gospel of Matthew. And we're calling it Kingdom Culture because we've, all of us, I think, are aware that around us in North American society, people are saying and doing things in the name of Jesus and as Christian people and in the name of the church that sometimes we are scratching our heads and going, what does this have to do with what Jesus is like and what his teaching is like? And so we're returning as a community to the Gospel of Matthew and the stories and teaching of Jesus so that we can listen to Jesus for ourselves and sort through what it means for us to talk to him. And so we're looking to take on the posture of learners, of apprentices, of people who are willing to start again and again in our understanding of things so that there's space in our room, so there's space and room in our minds and hearts to actually listen to Jesus and allow him to lead us and teach us. So that's what being apprentices is all about. It's about recognizing that we don't have it all together and that we need to learn. And we have the opportunity to learn. And so we're seeking to do that. So as we open our Bible to Matthew 5, we're going to be looking at verses 27 to 30. I have a question for you. And here's my question. What is your posture as we come to the scriptures this morning? I've asked you this before. And as I was thinking about it this morning, I thought, I'm going to ask you again, what is your posture as we come to the Bible this morning? That's a bit of a loaded question, actually. So when I say, what's your posture? You might be thinking, oh, so what Brian wants me to do now is humbly accept everything he says as coming directly from God, and I'm supposed to believe and do it. You might think that that's what I'm angling for. That's actually not what I'm saying. I think that's how cults form. When a speaker says, everything I say comes from God, and you need to believe it. That's a good formula for starting a cult. One of the aspects of Jesus that's so evident in the stories that have been passed down to us about him is the way that he deeply respected people's capacity to listen and to make choices for themselves. If they wanted, they could respond how they chose to respond, and he respected that in them. As far as I can tell, Jesus wasn't spiritually abusive in the least. Let me say that again. As far as I can tell, and it's interesting to think about this, Jesus wasn't spiritually abusive in the least, even though he was the Son of God. There's no hint of coercion or manipulation in his teaching whatsoever. Have you ever thought about that? There's no hint of coercion or manipulation in his teaching. I don't think there is. Question: you could jump in and disagree with me if I'm wrong. He spoke hard and direct warnings to people. Some of them are just like explosive in their implications. But he left it up to his listeners to respond and sort through what they were going to do with his words. Wow. I find that so encouraging. So in the gathering, we want to be that kind of community. So here's another thing about Jesus as we think about our posture as a community and how we relate to others in the broader community as well. We're going to be talking a bit today about sexuality, which is an explosive issue, a contentious issue. Jesus never shamed people. Think about that for a minute. Jesus never shamed people. As I thought about that this morning, I wrote down here, it makes me want to cry when I think about that. I'm serious. I've had so much shame in my own life, in my own sexual journey, and Jesus always treats me with dignity and respect as a human being, and with compassion and grace. So hear me on this. That doesn't mean for a moment that Jesus approves of everything that I've done. But in the midst of those failures, he treats me with dignity and respect, and he forgives and he restores. That's just amazing. So I said that Jesus never shamed people. That's actually not quite true, I don't think. Again, test me on this. I would say that the closest Jesus comes to shaming people is his response to the judgmental religious leaders of his day who were quick to cast judgment on those who didn't follow their rules. So read Matthew 23 later today if you want. That's the closest Jesus comes to shaming people. Amazing. So I just want to put that out there as kind of a foundation for the conversation we're going to have today about this teaching in Matthew chapter 5. Let me just pray with us before a little bit more before we continue. Lord Jesus, thank you for all the gifts that you give to us. And thank you especially for the gift of relationships, the gift of sexuality that expresses itself in so many ways in our lives and is so rich in the gifts that it gives to us. Thank you for that, God, for the way you've made us. Help us today to be able to affirm our sexuality and to hear your teaching for what it is. And Lord, this is explosive stuff to talk about. That word just keeps coming to mind. And I just pray you'd help us to hear you, Jesus. And there's so many ways that we could go off the tracks in this conversation, even this morning, because we're coming at this conversation from so many different perspectives. And Lord, I just pray that you would just in your kindness, just help each of us to hear what you want us to hear today. Thank you. Amen. So I said this before, I'll say it again. I really encourage you to read the words of Jesus for yourself. It's one thing to listen to me or to Dale or somebody else talk about him. Just come back, read them for yourself, and just invite Jesus to speak to you. I think that just is a really important part of what we're doing here. So we're in Matthew 5. We interrupted our trip through Matthew 5 in part because Lent started and we jumped ahead to Matthew 6. 3 weeks ago, we heard that Jesus' purpose wasn't to abolish the teaching of the Old Testament, but actually to fulfill it and to complete it. And then he began to teach what that would look like in daily life. And you'll recall that he began with anger and murder. Do you remember that? That was 3 weeks ago. We talked about that. So the basic message was that in his new kingdom, simply avoiding actually killing the people around you isn't good enough. That doesn't actually make a very good, healthy, whole community when people are picking up rocks and hitting themselves on the head, hitting the people around them with it. And we talked explicitly about some of that stuff. Jesus calls us beyond just not killing people to paying attention to the anger and scorn and derision that arise in our hearts and our relationships with others, and to take initiative in making things right when we've wronged others. So Jesus calls us to be a radically reconciling community. And actually thinking not just about how we've wronged other people, how other people have wronged us and forgiving them, but thinking about how we've wronged other people and taking initiative to go and make things right. So kingdom culture, which is what we're talking about, is a group of people living radically reconciled lives with each other, or learning how to live radically reconciled lives with each other. And that challenges us in a bunch of different ways. So now we're going to go to the next section. So he's moving from one section to the next, one aspect of life to the next. And this is teaching about faithfulness in relationships, in marriage and adultery, and it's tied in then to teaching about divorce and the saying of vows. So I invite you to read along with me. Verse 27, you've heard the commandment that says you must not commit adultery. But I say to you, anyone who even looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So if your eye, even your good eye, causes you to lust, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your hand, even your stronger hand, causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Wow. So this morning, I'm just going to deal with one or two aspects of these verses, and then next week we're going to return and we're going to also link them to the teaching on divorce and taking oaths. So as I read and reflected on these words this week, at times, particularly early on in the week, I found myself getting angry. I found myself getting angry at God and even angry at Jesus. It's like, this is too hard. This isn't doable. This standard is too high. We're too broken and messed up to live with this kind of virtue with each other. Like I genuinely experienced that. And then I stopped back, pulled back and thought, okay, well then what am I saying? Am I saying it's impossible for people to keep their marriage proposals to each other? Is it impossible for people married or single to not objectify each other and use each other as objects of lust to fuel their internal fantasies? Is that what I'm saying when I'm saying this is too hard? And if that's the case, is there hope for the human community? And so I found myself caught. On one hand, as a guy, kind of avoid the fact that I'm a guy here today, I'm feeling like this is too hard. And then on the other hand, I'm going, well, yeah, but we need this if we're going to have a community that has any kind of health and wholeness. So how do you find yourself responding as you hear these words of Jesus? I invite you to chat that out as you listen. When you hear this, how does it trigger you? What comes out of you as you hear this teaching from Jesus? So I think the meaning, the basic meaning of Jesus' words are pretty clear. The Ten Commandments include the command, do not commit adultery. And I looked them up this morning as I was thinking about this. This is from Exodus 20. So it starts with this idea of God rescues the people. He's doing this reclamation project where he's calling people out of humanity to be restored in their relationship with him so that he can show them what it means to live under his kingdom and his care and his provision. And he says, don't have any other gods before you. In other words, if you want to get your life straight, you have to start with worshiping the one who is truly God. And then he invites them. He says, don't make yourself idols. Don't misuse the name of the Lord your God. Keep the Sabbath. Honor your father and mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. By adultery, he's saying, don't be faithful to your wife and respect others by being faithful to your wife. Don't be having sexual relations with other people outside of marriage. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, or his manservant or his maidservant. So we understand, and Jesus' audience would have understood what Jesus meant when he said, don't commit adultery. But Jesus, again, deepens the command and applies it to our inner life, to our thoughts, and to our desires. So it would seem that in this new kingdom, Jesus is, again, not just looking for outward obedience, but that we would actually become faithful to each other at a heart level and the ways we use our eyes and our thoughts to look at each other and think about each other. Wow. So Jesus is teaching, I think, that you and I can be unfaithful to our marriage vows in our minds without ever touching the person that I'm thinking about. And Jesus says that in this new kingdom he's creating, that kind of adultery matters. So he warns his followers, you and I, to take drastic action so that our illegitimate desires don't pull our whole lives in the direction of God's judgment. Wow, this is intense. So here's a principle of the kingdom that I hear in this as we think about kingdom culture. So faithfulness or virtue begins in the heart, not just sexually, but in every area of life. Faithfulness begins in the heart. It begins in the mind. Please notice with me at this point that Jesus doesn't tell us how human beings are supposed to attain this kind of virtue, only that it's really important that they do it. But I would add, however, as we talk about this, that these verses have become in our church tradition, and I think rightfully so, the guide for sexual purity for single people as well, in that the principle of what faithfulness in our relationships looks like applies in those other contexts as well. So I think that's what's happened in our culture. Our church culture, and I think to some degree that that's appropriate. So this standard, this is like the gold standard for relational and sexual virtue that Jesus kind of lays out there, demanding as it is. So let me just make a couple of observations and share a few responses with you from people who are part of the gathering who weighed in on this a little bit with me, because I recognize that I need help here. So first question, why does Jesus speak in this instance only to men, to husbands? Why does Jesus speak only to men? It's very clear that he does. I think that one way of thinking about that is because at that time, and probably to some degree today too, the patriarchal approach to adultery was that it was excusable for the husband, but not for the wife. In other words, the man could be sexually active outside of his primary commitment to his wife. But the woman couldn't. So men could do what they wanted. It didn't seem to matter. So we see this even in the Jewish culture of Jesus' day, in the story of from John 8, where religious leaders were trying to trap Jesus, and they publicly brought to Jesus the woman that was caught in adultery. And the big question that comes to mind is, why did they just bring the woman? Where's the guy? And I think that is an expression of the culture of that day, where it was understood that the man could do as he pleased. The woman was the adulteress. So here's what a woman from the gathering said when I asked her what she heard when she read these verses from Matthew. And I quote this. This is a direct quote. I quote, "I resent the so-called purity culture that makes women responsible to keep men from lusting. We are taught to be modest, to think of how to keep boys from sinning by the way we dress. We're not responsible for that. And I wonder if some of the rampant sexual abuse in the church is related to the fact that girls are made responsible from adolescence on because men cannot control that aspect of their lives. Bullshit. Men are responsible for their own thoughts and feelings. Women are responsible for theirs. Alcohol is readily available, and alcoholics are responsible to keep themselves sober. The covering up of women to save men has tried and failed too. Look at cultures where women wear burqas. Rape is still prevalent. I think Jesus is saying that sin is the responsibility of the one whose heart it lives in, and we are to deal with our sins seriously and severely." End of quote. Thank you for sharing that, for just speaking it as you've experienced it. Here are some comments from a man who's part of the gathering. I quote, "The statistics of the percentage of women that will face sexual assault at some point in their life, regardless of how modestly they dress, are really damning. And the culture that creates this probability always starts in our thought life." So the idea that Jesus was so serious about people not letting their fantasies become unhealthy is really appealing to people who want to see rape culture ended. End of quote. So one of the questions that came to my mind as I was reading this is, why does Jesus give such a stark warning about this kind of sexual unfaithfulness? He only uses this kind of warning, like if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out, in one other place. And that's where he's talking about later in Matthew. I believe it's in Matthew, when people cause children and his disciples to fall away from him. He uses that same challenging language there. So why is Jesus so intense about this? Well, I'm in danger of interpreting this in terms of what's happening right now in our culture, but if you've been following the news, you'll notice that even in our culture this week, I won't say names, there are leading figures who have postured as being something different and have now been exposed as being abusive to the women under their authority. They've misused their power and have been abusive to the women that have worked in their organizations. So why is Jesus being so intense? I wonder if it's because people in power, in this case, men, often give ourselves a pass when it comes to the objectification of women. We don't just tolerate it, we even nurture it, and it's rampant in our world. Wow. So Jesus is saying, this is serious. This is toxic in a community. So it helped me this week to read this phrase. I forget who wrote it. It's, Jesus is leading us into a whole new way of being human. Jesus is leading us into a whole new way of being human. And in this, Jesus is moving us in that direction. We see where the kingdom is going, to relational purity and relational virtue. And he's moving us in that direction. Not that we're going to experience it fully here and now, but he's inviting us as he gives us strength by his spirit to move in that direction. So another woman from the gathering said this, I quote, "When I read these verses in light of my own experiences in life, I know that adultery starts in the heart and comes out at how we look at each other. The eyes are the window to the soul. Sadly, over the years, I have met many men who I believe, because of their distorted views of what love is, have interpreted kindness as an invitation. Everything is about sex to them, when in reality, so little is about sex. Most of life is about relationship, and all of our relationships are colored by the condition of our hearts. End of quote. Thank you. So a writer by the name of Scott McKnight says, points this out, and I think it's really important to hear this. We also live in one of the most egalitarian societies in history, where men and women are increasingly seen as equals, where women too express their own sexual needs and wants. So it needs to be said that women also objectify males and the male body. Jesus' words in this text prohibit objectification of any sort. So I just want to speak to this just for a moment, because where does this come from? What's the root of objectification and lust? And I think about my own story. I grew up without TV. We had CBC growing up in the 80s. I was in my teens in the 80s. Not much access to movies. We had VHSs, but not as much access to movies. We didn't have the internet, if you can imagine, with all of the prevalence of images that our kids can see on their cell phones wherever they're at. And yet, as I look back, I didn't need anyone to teach me how to objectify women. I'd figured that out by the time I was in junior high, all on my own. So where does that come from? And I've struggled with it ever since, just to be honest. Seems to me that in our turn away from God as human community, our sexuality has been distorted, and it's become predatory in many ways. And we prey on each other, and we use each other rather than respecting and loving each other. And we need somebody to save us. So that's the first question. Second question is this. Yeah, again, feel free to chat at any point here. Second question, is Jesus teaching us that our sexuality is a bad thing? Because it almost seems like the way he's talking here, we'd be better off without it. Is Jesus prohibiting sexual desire? Here's another quote from this fellow at the gathering. He said this, so many of my friends are just exhausted and embittered with purity culture. By purity culture, he means specifically the cultural movement that started in America in the 90s and spread here. People are frustrated with the way that we've taken these words of Jesus and essentially communicated any sexual feeling that you feel, not dwell on, but feel, outside of marriage is a sin, and that you should, and that piece of you should be cut off. So we have all these young people out there who completely demonizing any side of themselves that's sexual and God-breathed because they weren't given any tools to honor this piece of God's image within them. End of quote. Wow. So is Jesus speaking against the goodness of our sexuality? I don't think so. Not for a moment. We need to take these few verses and put them in the context of the teaching of the Bible as a whole. And we see in the creation story in Genesis, the goodness of God creating men and women and blessing them with the gift of sexuality. And then we see the Song of Solomon in the Old Testament, for instance, that is a whole book of the Bible that celebrates the gift of romantic and sexual desire. The Song of Solomon is erotic literature that celebrates passion and sexual intimacy and sexual pleasure. I know in working with pre-married couples, I will sometimes encourage them to spend a bit of time in the Song of Solomon, but I tell them, don't do that too soon. do that the week before you're actually going to get married. Now, there's some truth to that, but part of that is also part of the problem, is how do we actually embrace this powerful gift of sexuality in our culture? For those of us that aren't married or are single, or maybe hope to be married but aren't, or maybe don't hope to be married but still want to affirm our sexuality in positive ways, how do we do that with this powerful gift that God has given to us? So my understanding is that Jesus teaches the control and channeling of sexual desire into marriage. Jesus isn't trying to argue that we somehow try to eliminate sexual desire or in any way shame ourselves for being sexual. It's actually hard to do, as I'm just thinking as I'm talking here, as I think of what it was like in my 20s. It's actually hard to embrace your sexuality as a single person and manage it and channel it without it becoming something that leads outside of God's intentions for us. So I just want to acknowledge the difficulty of this. This is, and I don't know, I can't take that away. This is really challenging. And I think it would be wrong for us to say that this isn't really challenging, that there aren't easy answers for how we relate, to how we handle our sexuality, how we affirm our sexuality, how we learn to control our sexuality. So when Jesus says, if your eye causes you to stumble, tear it out, I think he was communicating with vivid language our need to take sexual self-control seriously. He wasn't telling us, I don't think, that sexuality is bad or wrong or not to be celebrated. So I'm almost done. There's a lot here that we could talk about. And I recognize, if you're processing along with me, that I'm raising as many questions as I'm answering. I'm not sure I'm answering any questions, actually, but I'm raising some of them. So allow me to dump out a few questions, and then I'll give you a chance to respond. Question number one. So we live in a culture, you may have heard this phrase, sex positive. I heard that phrase a lot in the previous work I did with AIDS programs, South Saskatchewan. And sex positive means any kind of sexual expression is good and needs to be affirmed as long as it is consensual and doesn't hurt children. So I think that is a reaction in part against the purity culture that came out of the church and against the teaching of the church confining sexuality to marriage. So the phrase is sex positive. I don't believe that Jesus is teaching that approach to sexuality. Jesus affirms the goodness of sexuality while at the same time warning us of its dangers. So in our sex-saturated culture, how do we celebrate the goodness of sexuality while avoiding the dangers and harm we can do to each other when we don't manage our desires well? So the title for this teaching is Beyond Desire. So the title implicates, the implication of the title is that desire isn't everything, that we need to submit our desires to the teaching of Jesus. Second question, I've kind of asked it already, but I want to say it again. How does one follow this as a single person in our culture where sex is idolized and life without sex is sometimes characterized as being terribly deficient? In other words, you can't be whole unless you're having great sex. This is challenging. Jesus celebrated singleness and community and invites people to choose singleness as a way of living fully unto God as complete human beings. So this is a message that I think the church and the evangelical church that we sometimes haven't done good at, where we've so almost idolized the married state that single people feel like they're somehow less than fully whole. And I think that has not been good. So Jesus actually lifts up singleness as something that's desirable and even something that you would seek in order to live fully unto God in his kingdom. Another question. How do we speak the language of our culture when it comes to sexuality? I'm almost scared to ask this question. How do we speak the language of our culture when it comes to sexuality? How do we speak about this without condemning people? So Bruxy Cavey said these words, the sexual vision of the kingdom doesn't apply, this is my paraphrase, the sexual vision of the kingdom of Jesus doesn't apply to people who aren't followers of Jesus. So that's a starting place. We can't expect people to follow or even agree with this teaching who haven't heard or understood the teaching of Jesus. And so why would we feel the need to judge them? How do we live and relate to people in such a way that what we say and do doesn't push them away from Jesus and his kingdom, rather than invite them to check it out? Those are hard questions. And I heard a story this week on a podcast, and it was a young woman reflecting on her sexual journey and what Jesus was calling her to. She didn't grow up with the teaching of the church at all. Fascinating story. And just made her decisions about what was appropriate or not appropriate sexually based on just her own internal compass, and had no guidance really from her parents or from anybody else. But as she got to learn to follow Jesus and experienced his love and his care, she found herself in a position to trust Jesus with what he was asking her to do sexually and relationally, because she knew him. And it requires trust. And so her message was for people to ask other people, or for Christian people to ask non-Christian people, or people who aren't disciples of Jesus, to give up things to follow Jesus when they don't yet know Jesus and trust him doesn't make sense. It's as you come to experience Jesus and his love and his care that you can begin to trust him with the important things in your life. Do you agree? All of us are on that journey. But if you don't know Jesus in that way yet as the giver of good gifts, how can you open up your hands with the things that make life worth living for you right now unless you trust that Jesus is going to actually lead you into something that's good? So I think there's a real invitation there for us to back away from judgment and to lean into relationship with the people around us. Okay, that's a lot of content. Wow. So Jesus isn't just giving us moral commands. Yeah, I'm reflecting a bit on what Dale talked about last week about how we build boxes. Jesus is unveiling a whole new way of being human, and it can look strange to people because it's so different. But Jesus invites us to know him first. And then as we get to know him, we can begin to follow him and experience his healing in our lives and his direction in our lives. Two questions. One is just for you to think about personally. And then I just want to open it up for some short dialogue for us to talk about as a community. So this is one for you to think about personally. What invitation are you hearing from Jesus today as you consider your relationships and sexuality? So the assumption here is that all of us need ongoing renewal and healing in this area of our lives. How can the church become a relational space that helps people experience the grace and truth of Jesus' new kingdom with our sexuality and relationships?